Sie hören eine Veranstaltung der Leipziger Buchmesse. Für die Inhalte ist die Leipziger Buchmesse nicht verantwortlich. Viel Spaß beim Hören.
Aber er ist der Engländer, ja, der Verräter.
Ich möchte unbedingt.
Ich kann nicht nur flüssig sprechen, aber wenn später eine kleine Diskussion geben wir. Sie können natürlich Fragen auf Deutsch stellen, aber wirklich kann ich nicht Deutsch aktiv sprechen. Ja.
Ich hatte eigentlich gehofft, dass das nicht verraten wird, dass ich.
Ah, ja, ja.
Zu spät. Weil es fängt gut an. I will begin also by a strange move, to introduce myself. My name is Jan Völker. I'm a philosopher working at the Berlin University of the Arts. And it's my big pleasure to welcome one of the world's most important and most famous philosophers, Slavoj Žižek.
Do you have visions? You should go to psychiatrist, you know.
And also one of the most, it needs to be said, one of the most important political voices our days. But we have 30 minutes for our conversation, and I could easily spend those 30 minutes by trying an introduction of your works and only summing up the countless books you have been writing. So instead of "this man needs no introduction," this time I would rather say we don't have the time. So we have to skip the introduction, and we rather start for what we are here, namely the presentation of your new German book, so Disparitäten, published just a few days ago by the Wissenschaftliche Buchgesellschaft, and that's what we are here for. And I think just one single word on the book. I mean it, and I immediately start. I mean, as you write yourself, it can be divided in three parts. It follows the metaphysical holy trinity of the true, the beautiful, and the good. No, so, and you could say these three parts, the true, the beautiful, the good, relate to the question, the true, to the question of the object and science, and the beautiful, obviously, to the question of art. And then in the last part, the aspect of the good to a question of ethics with and without God, to put it like this. Yeah, maybe we can later talk about this. But then on the second layer, it's, of course, I need to say, also a rereading of Hegel and a presentation of a different Hegel than perhaps we have in other different, rather pragmatic or American readings of Hegel. And so against the usual official Hegel that is the final thinker of reconciliation, you present a different Hegel, a Hegel that comes perhaps with a twist in itself. So a Hegel that is perhaps in itself not only Hegel, but always already more than Hegel. No? And I think maybe it would be a good start to, if you could say a word about the title, because the title, as you explain in the book, of course, but I assume that most of us hadn't read it yet, the title refers to a word in Hegel, and there is a specific twist about it that you call, that you use disparity instead of Ungleichheit, or a special effect. So
it's a wonderful question you ask, because you know how you arrogant Germans, this is meant as praising you. I like arrogant people. I hate these politically correct people, you know. You are never arrogant. You are afraid that you don't hurt anyone. No, I want to hurt people to the end. So, you like to complain how in English translations, Übersetzungen von Hegel oder Kant, so much gets lost. What shocked me here is that everybody knows that often David Kemp Smith, the official translator of Kant, sometimes at his best, he makes Kant in English, and many Kantians admit this, better than the original. And this is one of the few examples, it was not David Kemp, when Hegel speaks about, he gives a formula of his system. When he says that the starting point of our experience is we are here, the absolute is there, or God, or whatever. So how to overcome this disparity. And this is why I consider myself an atheist Christian. Because I think something unique happens here in Christendom, Christianity. It's not, the Christian solution is not, okay, I'm a fallen being, God is there, so if I work hard, purify myself, suffer, I will rejoin God. No, it is to discover that the gap that separates me from God already separates God from himself. So that at the very point where I am separated from God, I am included, identified with Christ on the cross, who says, you know, Eli, Eli, lama, sabachthani, Father. So this, and this is a key passage, Hegel uses the simple term Ungleichheit, or what, no? That the, it's not that we are separated from the absolute. The absolute is separated from itself, but again, the English translation uses the term disparity, which is, I think, much better than Ungleichheit. Second point, as you pointed out, this is to define in brief terms this book. I'm not kidding, unfortunately. It's a book of post-coital depression. I did the big, fat book, Weniger als Nichts, less than nothing.
Well, this and is then, a small book rather than...
Yeah. And then, after finishing it, over 1,000 pages, I was literally awakened by nightmares, but in all those 1,000 pages, didn't I forget to say the crucial? So, the first post-coital book was Absoluter Gegenstoß, appeared by Fischer, and then I had the same depression, and it's here. The good thing about this book, I think, now I'm trying to make it attractive, is that, as you hinted at, it's a very polemical book. It's a settling of accounts with friends, or not friends. The most important, maybe, I think it's Kapitel 3, Chapter 3, is the one about today's predominant reading of Hegel, characterized by two words, Anerkennung and Versöhnung. And I think it's, of course, the representatives of this reading, with vague reference to Habermas, are Michael Brandon, John McDowell, then also Robert Pippin, and so on. What they do is, let me call it in this way, renormalize Hegel. They think that to make Hegel actual for today, one should translate his confused dialectical thinking into our normal experience. I think that no, precisely the apparent madness of Hegel should be saved. And why is this so interesting? As you probably know, till about 50, 40 years ago, there were two readings of Hegel vaguely predominant. The right-wing conservative reading, Hegel as a critic of modern liberalism on behalf of a more organic vision of society, and the leftist revolutionary Hegel. As to this first reading, now to provoke you with another thing, I hope you can follow somehow what I'm saying. I think Hegel is, and that's what I try to prove also in this book, Hegel is perhaps, his system is not a closed system. It's the most open you can imagine. Why? Back to my line. Now we have a third Hegel, the liberal Hegel. All these Anerkennungs readers of Hegel try to present Hegel as a thinker the goal of whose system is mutual Anerkennung, recognition. In this sense, an equal society. But you know, the first thing to remember is this. You remember that famous phrase from the end of Introduction to Hegel's, no, Vorrede, Rechtsphilosophie, where Hegel says, the owl of Minerva flies off in the evening, we can develop a concept of a social order only when this social order is already in its decay. But was Hegel really such an idiot not to know that this holds for his own system in Rechtsphilosophie? Hegel's Rechtsphilosophie, where he presents his model of almost sometimes sounds a little bit proto-fascist corporate state, he is there not presenting a model of ideal state. He's describing something, the ideal, begriffliche Struktur, of something whose time has already passed. And what about the future? Hegel prohibits this question. And that's another part of my reading of Hegel. Hegel is not a teleological thinker. He thinks future is totally undetermined. He has teleology, but it's always a retroactive teleology. You know who provided here the best formula for what dialectical process means? The great conservative poet, I often quote him, George T.S. Eliot, no, sorry, Thomas Stearns Eliot, who said in his famous essay on tradition and individual talent or whatever, that every new revolutionary work of art does not only present the break with the past, but it retroactively changes the entire past. It imposes us to rewrite the whole history of the past. And in this sense, for me, Hegel is totally an open philosopher who is open towards the future. And he wasn't so bad there. Look at his Einleitung zu Philosophie der Geschichte. At two points, and these are his lecture from 1820, at two points there, when he talks about America and Russia, he says it's too early to talk about these countries. Next century, the 20th, will be their time. Ah, not too bad. So again, I try to provide a new reading. I cannot go, this is not the time of Hegel. This is one polemic. Then, before that, it comes a polemic against the guy who now unfortunately died, Stephen Hawking. This idea, which is now more and more influential, that, and it has a certain beauty, it fascinated me, that philosophy is dead today, in the sense that philosophy can just be a methodological reflection, but what once were philosophical questions? Do we have a free will? Is the universe created or not? Endlich, finite or not? These are questions that today are approached by science, by quantum cosmology, and so on. So Hawking somewhere aggressively put this, that philosophy is over. Philosophy can just give some methodological reflections, but today science deals even with questions which were one philosophical. I try to defend the legacy of philosophy here. I think that there still is a space for a properly philosophical reflection. Then, my third target, I'm giving you as an arch-Stalinist the list of enemies, is, I don't know how popular is it here in Deutschland, so-called, I don't know how to call it, new ontologies. Here in Germany you have Marcus Gabriel, you have Graham Harman, new materialists, and so on. I can understand this movement. In the 80s, up till, I would say, mid-90s, the epoch was deconstructionist. Like, most of what philosophy was doing was trying to deconstruct, historicize, or reflexively undermine any positive position. Like, take someone whom I otherwise appreciate highly as philosopher, Jacques Derrida. But if you ask me, what is his positive statement? What does he think? How is the universe structured? Even if you torture him, you will not get an answer from him. He will just say something like, basically, it's the ultimate form of historicism. For example, I always use this comical example. When you are to ask a deconstructionist or Foucauldian, referring to Michel Foucault, you know, what is this? He would say, first we have to reflect upon in what hermeneutic context can we even talk about this. So he would say, if we strategically allow a little bit of essentialism, then maybe this can be called a glass of water or whatever. You know, you are never there. Sorry, I will finish. If you are stupid enough to believe me, I will finish soon.
I'm not.
As a reaction to this, we got then in the last decade an explosion of new ontologies. Now we can see retroactively that already Gilles Deleuze is anti-Derrida, proposes this new ontology of multitudes, thriving of differences, productive differences, and so on. Then you have Marcus Gabriel here and others, but you have also these new forms of materialism. The idea is, let's get rid of transcendental reflection, of this transcendental solipsistic term. Let's, even if it is naive, describe reality the way it is. Open ourselves to the world.
Can I interrupt you for a second at this point, because I just want to squeeze in a question at this precise point, because in this settling of accounts in the first part, when it comes to object-oriented ontology and all new materialisms, you defend, of course, a specific notion and understanding and necessity of materialism. Now, the naive form of materialism, as you explain it, would say, okay, we start by describing the objects. We start by describing the reality of the things outside. And against this, you rather propose that to say that we only get to the notion of the object as such once we learn that abstraction is necessary. That abstraction does not bring us, take us far away from the empirical realm, but rather we have to think abstractly. Because you said you defend the notion of philosophy, I wondered whether you could perhaps explain a bit what you understand by abstraction, how the necessity of abstraction is.
Here, this is a very good question that you raised now, because here enters also, I don't want to be too pretentious there, I don't claim that I understand fully quantum physics. Nobody does. They themselves. Don't. But what I find so incredibly penetrating and still shocking is that quantum physics transposes abstraction or ignorant, not knowing, into reality itself. Ignorance is, for example, what would have been, I ask myself, the question of, or the notion of God, I'm an atheist, but let's say, that would fit quantum physics. Against Einstein, who liked to say, God may be tricky, but God doesn't cheat. Bohr's answer would have been, okay, maybe God doesn't cheat, but God can be cheated. That is to say, if God is this universal gaze which kind of guarantees the consistency of the universe, then what happens at this, I call it pre-ontological level of quantum oscillations, waves, is precisely something that escapes God. If we take God, not in a strict theological sense, but a guarantee of, in other words, it is crucial to take negative terms that you mentioned, that is to say, ignorance, abstraction, not just as limitations of our knowledge, in the sense of the world in itself, out there, it's full, it is just us who cannot get it all and must proceed through abstractions. No, abstractions are in reality itself. This brings me to what maybe, if you allow me, the last joke, is part of the new ontology or anti-ontology proposed by this book, this notion of unfinished, ontologically unfinished universe, reality which is not yet fully constituted. Mm-hmm. And here, I don't know if it's this book or another one, I used, and I hope I can use it with you, a wonderful example that I shamelessly took from an introduction to philosophy popular. I think that to understand quantum physics ontology, the best way to begin is with video games. What's the paradox with video games? Imagine you are in a video game and there is some forest or a house in the background. Usually it's not part of the game that you can enter that house. This is why it's not in the program of the game that you can enter that house. Ontologically, the inside of the house doesn't exist. I mean, from the standpoint of program. Or you cannot say, let me walk to that forest, I will see in detail the trees. You cannot. It's not part of the game. And, okay, what has this to do with quantum physics? My reading is this one. I simplify it, of course. You know when they speak of uncertainty principle, or it's not a precise term. The idea is precisely this one. The point is not, you know, that you cannot measure at the same time movement and mass or whatever, position of a particle. The point is not a particle has a position and a velocity, but we cannot measure it. The point is that it is in itself ontologically undetermined. So what is my reading, ironic? That, ironically, of course, God was lazy. He thought that we humans are more stupid than we are. He thought, wait a minute, humanity in its science will never penetrate beyond atoms, inside the atom. So why should I lose time with programming the particles, how they move and so on? They're too stupid to get at it, you know. But we were a little bit too bright for God. We, as it were, caught God, as they say in English, with his pants down. Now, the last point. Concept in this sense of God, as simply the ultimate guarantee of consistency of order, I'm not saying we can, here I'm much more serious, we can simply get rid of it. I try to deal with what is my favorite chapter of the book, one before the last, on this virtual God. I think the title is, if you don't like this, then you are lost. Is God unconscious, finite, mortal, or just stupid, something like this? My thesis is this one. It's, I think, quite a nice joke. I refer to an old Arab, maybe Arab, you never know, story. Maybe you know it. About my thesis is that I think it's the 12th camel, 12th. Is the name of God. In what sense? It's a, don't be afraid, it's a very short story. An old merchant dies, and he has, I hope I will get the numbers right, correct me.
Try.
He leaves to his children 11 camels. He has 3 sons, the eldest, middle, the youngest. And he said, the eldest gets half, the next one gets, I think, 1/4, and the next one, 1/6.
Something like that,
yeah. And he said, but they only get the camels if they are exactly divided, like, and there are 11 camels. How can you give to someone half? of 11. You cannot cut it alive. Then they asked a wise old man who said, I will solve the problem. I will add one camel. And we have 12 camels. Then let's divide it. The oldest one gets half, which is 6. The next one gets 1/4, which is 3. And the next one gets 1/6, which is 2. 6, 3 and 2 is how much? 11. And I take back my camel. You see the logic. Something doesn't function, it's not consistent. You add an imagined virtual element, everything acquires meaning. But it's a purely virtual element. And believe me, the book is not at this level of joke. I try to develop in detail how, in this sense, I even don't like to use the word illusion. I would just say fiction, not in this pejorative sense, that God is, in this sense, a necessary fiction.
Okay, can I? This is a good point to try to interrupt you one last time.
You see, this is how you say in polite way, you talked enough, shut up. Okay.
In polite way. Because time is running away, and I wanted to ask you one, because there's one part of the book which we haven't been speaking about, but which I think is specific.
Which one? Hitler, Schiller, fascism? No.
Schiller.
Yeah.
Schiller, and especially the question of art. I mean, the question of art and the relation, and Schiller is a part already of the third part, so, but these two, and I mean, this refers to the very known thesis of Hegel of the end of art. No, we don't bend our knee anymore to the realm of art. Art doesn't have the symbolic power anymore to orient our social lives. And so there is an end of this symbolic power of art for Hegel, and rather we are now being instructed by science, for example. Mm. And now your reading proposes, I mean, somehow touches upon the problem how to explain with Hegel the notion of modern art, although...
To be honest, I will give you immediately back the word. Here, although he is an enemy, but he is not an idiot, I advise you to read his book, Robert Pippin, I forgot the title, Hegel and Modern Art, where he gives a wonderful reading of Manet paintings and so on, and develops in an extremely convincing way how Hegel was simply not radical enough in his own terms, how we can develop a notion of modern abstract art on Hegel. Sorry.
But you disagree in points with him also.
In points, but...
I think the interesting point here is the question of the ugly or the abject, no? And I was wondering whether you would say that it is precisely because, I mean, actually you say art is confronting us with something that is abject or minimalized, the survival of the pure partial object, for example, something that we cannot actually cope with, no? And I was wondering how you understand this how you understand this within Hegel. Now, is the question of modern art for you something that can be solved or explained with Hegel, but is precisely a point at which in Hegel something evolves that is more than Hegel, modern art, no?
All the time, absolutely. Yeah. And I will give you here a nice example. You remember, if you read the end of Hegel's Aesthetics, he asked the question, what type of, he speaks more about narrative literature experience, can still be thought after this final reconciliation, the end of history for Hegel. And Hegel uses some strange terms which basically mean this. Reconciliation means that we no longer have a big tragic experience. In classical works of art, if I have an enemy or an unfortunate love, this always, how my tragic situation develops, always helps eine weltgeschichtliche Bedeutung. Through my conflict, a certain historical tension is enacted. Now we just get individual problems. I get cancer, you have a happy love, and I envy you, I want to kill you, whatever. But the point is that these are not conflicts which have a wider historical relevance. Mm-hmm. It just contingently happens here and there. Mm-hmm. And I, in my crazy thesis, admit it, it's a nice one. I was so furious when I discovered that an American student of mine already proposed it. Is that, you know, this stupid endless TV series, melodramatic, that this is really what Hegel had in mind. You know, look at Seinfeld and all that. No tragedy happens, just meaningless local conflict. Mm-hmm. But this is not all. Another wonderful category of Hegel is where he speaks about romantic irony. He brutally opposes it. Like romantic irony for... he claims this is subjective arrogance. I always wanted to be a little bit wiser than reality, and so on. But then he opposes to this something that he, Hegel, calls, wonderful term, objektiver humor. Objective humor. But to conclude in a political way, isn't this our situation? Subjective irony are all those stupid critics of Donald Trump who more and more arrogantly make fun of him while Trump is more and more winning, my God. Objective humor would have been something much more horrible. A humor. Humorous reversal tensions, which are not my subjective exaggeration, but are inscribed into reality itself. Already with Trump, how can you make fun of Trump? He is, in some sense, already his own parody. He will always beat you. Or, I use this example, political jokes humor. Can you imagine a greater joke than Stalinist trials? They're monstrous, but these crazy reversals, humor in the sense of these crazy reversals and so on, is already part of the worst totalitarian social reality and so on and so on. So, yes, I agree with you. One of my obsessions here also is precisely how to think with Hegel beyond Hegel.
Okay, that is a wonderful concluding word. Time is unfortunately already...
This is what I like, because I hate debates. Listen, I like dialogues, but I like dialogues of late Plato. You know how are they structured? One guy talks all the time, and every 10 minutes the other guy says something like, by Zeus, yes, so it is, and so on. This is the dialogues I like.
I know.
So I want for us to talk too much, so that now I can say with utmost hypocrisy, I'm so sorry that we don't have the time for questions and answers. Fuck off. It's over.
Thank you very much, Slava.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. And let me say, if you are from here, how much I admire the city of Leipzig. Already when I was young, I am an elitist. I followed closely, even in DDR-Zeiten, Gewandhaus, the orchestra. I am here a Hegelian idealist. Just the last note. You know when Hegel said, in a wonderful idealist madness, that the Peloponnesian War was really fought so that Thucydides was able to write a book about it. In a way, this is true, spiritually. Isn't it that? Why do we still know about Elizabethan England? Its objective spiritual function was to enable Shakespeare to write his games. And I think, in some sense, the same goes for Leipzig. You deserve to exist because you gave birth to Gewandhaus. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You will leave in English.
Sorry?
You will leave in English.
Yeah, but we have another
English.
I will be there.
Danke fürs Zuhören. Wir sehen uns auf der nächsten Leipziger Buchmesse.